You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
we're trying to deprive ISIL of the overall ability to wage this, not just in Kobani, but throughout Syria and into Iraq.
The battle for Kobani continues, as does the West's struggle to assemble a coherent and effective response to ISIS. Raffaello Pantucci and George Brock will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories. We'll be looking at the role of social media as a recruitment and propaganda tool for Islamist extremists, as various tech grandees are summoned to a summit by EU ministers. And we'll be asking whether President Uhuru Kenyatta's appearance in The Hague signals intent to cooperate with the ICC or obstruct it further.
There have been problems with witnesses going missing, witnesses deciding they don't want to give evidence anymore. And the ICC hasn't really come to terms with the idea that it is now trying to prosecute a man who has the entire apparatus of the Kenyan state behind him.
We'll also be heading to Morocco, which is celebrating the opening of its first contemporary art gallery in the middle of a very bad PR week. And we'll check in with our correspondent in Vancouver and yuck it up with our comedy reviewer. And we may even have time for some characteristically mellifluous music. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. An action-packed 59 minutes ahead of us, as usual. But before all that, Suzanne Chislett has the latest news.
Intense gunfights are continuing in the Syrian border town of Kobani, where Kurdish fighters are trying to force out Islamic militants. US airstrikes have destroyed armoured vehicles and artillery belonging to the extremists, appearing to slow down their progress. But local officials say more help is needed if the three-week assault on Kobani is to be defeated. The British Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond, is in Washington, where he and his US counterpart, Secretary of State John Kerry, have been discussing the international strategy.
Notwithstanding the crisis in Kobani, the original targets of our efforts have been the command and control centers, the infrastructure. We're trying to deprive the ISIL of the overall ability to wage this, not just in Kobani, but throughout Syria and into Iraq.
Doctors in Dallas say the man who was being treated for Ebola has died. Thomas Eric Duncan flew into the US from his native Liberia, where he contracted the virus. In Spain, the nurse who became infected after treating two missionaries says she has no idea how the virus was transmitted. Teresa Romero has spoken to a media organization by phone. As the human cost of the virus continues to mount, the World Bank is warning the outbreak will also have a major impact on the region's economy. It estimates West Africa could lose $32.6 billion because of Ebola by the end of 2015. Alistair McCaig is a market analyst at IG.
I think anything that might cause investors and companies to hesitate before embarking on operations inside Africa is obviously going to be a negative. The fact that the contagion of this seems to be far from under control at this stage will see many hesitate before embarking on any new projects and potentially suspending those that might be in the process of being brought up to fruition.
The UN Human Rights Office says at least 3,600 people were killed and more than 8,000 wounded in violence in eastern Ukraine between mid-April and October the 6th. A monthly report by UN monitors in the country says at least 331 deaths have been recorded since the ceasefire came into effect last month. Israeli police have clashed with young Palestinians in and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem on the eve of a Jewish holiday. The protesters were driven into the mosque from where they've continued to throw stones and Molotov cocktails. Israeli officials say three policemen were slightly wounded earlier when they tried to disperse a crowd of masked stone throwers near the Maghrabi Gate next to the Western Wall. Mickey Rosenfeld is a police spokesman.
The Israeli police and its special patrol units responded to disturbances this morning on the Temple Mount by masked Arabs who threw stones, petrol bombs. As a result, three police officers were injured, lightly treated at the scene. And we've heightened security in and around the old city ahead of the Sukkot festival, which is beginning later on tonight. Our police units, undercover units, border police and special patrol units will be in different areas to secure the thousands of people that will be visiting in Jerusalem.
Lawyers acting for the Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, at the International Criminal Court have called for crimes against humanity charges against him to be dropped. He's accused of orchestrating a wave of violence which swept Kenya after the 2007 election and being complicit in the murder of more than 1,200 people. The president, who became the first sitting world leader to appear before the court, denies the charges against him. The Chinese government says it saved $9 billion in spending on perks in the past year by cutting the cost of overseas trips, lavish receptions and official cars. More than 150,000 ghost jobs where people are paid even if they don't turn up for work were also found in the cleanup. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Suzanne. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It's 18.06 here in London. That's 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on today's news, I have in the studio Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University. Welcome both. We will be starting tonight along the Turkey-Syria border, where, as we go to air, the besieged town of Kobani has not yet quite fallen. The largely Kurdish fighters still defending Kobani from ISIS have been assisted over the last few hours by a stepping up of coalition airstrikes. Raffaello, I'll ask you first, these airstrikes, which have been ramped up fairly significantly in the last day, are they just delaying the inevitable?
No, I'm not sure that they totally are. I think the Kurds have been putting up a pretty good fight here, and they do seem to be in quite a negative position. But I think clearly the airstrikes are helping at least sort of keep ISIS to some degree at bay. They are getting closer, but I'm not sure that the city has completely fallen yet. And as I think the coverage seems to indicate, it's basically intense fighting with very substantial close air support. And I think that's a really key thing, is here that you've really got the sort of American-led forces, air forces, that are really operating in very close conjunction with the fighters on the ground to try to keep ISIS at bay.
George Brock, one of the defining visual images of the fight for Kobani so far has been the somewhat unedifying one of this town burning and being laid siege by militants while Turkey's artillery and tanks park on a nearby hill watching it all unfold. There have been various unflattering comparisons even made to the Red Army watching the Warsaw Ghetto burn in 1944. Why aren't Turkey moving?
Firstly, Turkey's entire military establishment is extremely worried about the Kurds. Kobani is essentially a Kurd town, and of all the trouble that Turkey has had with 15 million of its citizens, 20% of its population, who are Kurds, I think it is probably, or it is said, that it is the Syrian Kurds who the Turkish government dislike most. So their loyalties are extremely split and divided. They don't like ISIS, but they don't like the Kurds either. So they have also been having an argument with NATO about what they should be doing by way of defending Kobani. So there is a kind of partly slightly artificial tactical argument. They don't know which is the worse. Quite, they haven't decided which is the worst fate for them, really.
But this is already having fairly serious domestic repercussions in Turkey. 14 people were killed yesterday in protests in Turkey at a lack of action. How big a thing, Raffaello, do you think this could become domestically in Turkey? Because the thing is, even if this isn't, as some are suggesting, a calculated betrayal of the Kurds by Turkey, it could sure as hell be depicted as looking like it.
It certainly can. I can understand why you're having this whole question that's being raised. But I think what we're forgetting is that, frankly, Turkish hesitation to confront ISIS directly. The Turks have been very hesitant in doing this for a number of different reasons. I think on the one hand, because initially they were supporting the rebellion against the Assad regime, and a component of that was ISIS. Assad was their bigger enemy, so they focused on that rather than worrying particularly about the fact that you had this brewing jihadist insurgency across the border. I think then on the other hand, until recently we had this whole group of hostages, of Turkish hostages that were being held by the group in Iraq. And then on top of that, you got a question of if the the Turks really start to attack and confront ISIS directly. What does that mean for ISIS then deciding to launch attacks against them? You know, part of the problem here is that you've basically got a border, a very porous border between Turkey and these countries, which they've been letting people go back and forth across for quite some time. And part of that's because the Turks are letting it happen, but also because they don't have total control over that border. And so what happens if you confront a group that's just the other side to a point where that group decides to launch attacks? You know, if ISIS is going to launch attacks outside its immediate areas of control, it's going to be in neighboring countries. And we're talking about Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon as a first port of call. And for Turkey, it's just like a very dangerous border. So I think part of the question here is not so much about the Kurdish element, though clearly that's the one that's stirring all sorts of domestic problems. I think it's really about the Turks making a decision or not, and frankly, they're not making a decision, about whether they really want to throw their chips in and really confront ISIS in an aggressive way.
George Brock, that's the key right there, is Turkey not making a decision. An unnamed US official yesterday or today said that accused Turkey of inventing reasons to stay out. I don't think that's entirely fair, that they don't really need to be inventing reasons. Could it possibly be, trying to be sympathetic to Ankara's point of view, that they are, as people and indeed nations often do when confronted with an array of absolutely awful-looking choices, are just deciding to do nothing?
I think they think, they may well turn out to be wrong, but I think they almost start to believe that the less they do, the risk, which exists in every direction, may be a little bit smaller than all of the others. They really don't want, for exactly the reasons that Raffaele has explained, they really don't want ISIS as a direct enemy. But at the same time, they're very keen to see Syria fall. The other factor that Raffaele didn't quite so much mention is there's quite a lot of sympathy for IS in Turkey. Mm. The government has to be really rather careful that it doesn't find itself with an IS terrorism campaign on Turkish soil, very angry Kurds, of whom there are many millions, with quite a lot of sympathy for people who might be attacking them. That would be a major disaster and worse than being bitched at by the Americans as they are at the moment.
Raffaele, moving back to the air campaign such as it is, which has now been joined by Canada, among other nations now filling the skies over Iraq and Syria, desperately looking for things to blow up. Is it not becoming apparent to everybody, and Kobani yet another demonstration of it, that air power alone is not going to fix this?
Well, no, I don't think that anyone in their right mind really thinks that air power is the only solution to this problem. But I think the question becomes, well, who are the forces on the ground that you're providing air power for? And that's the question where everyone really lies. And you've had a lot of very high-level people here in the UK and another government say that, you know, this isn't going to get resolved until we've got boots on the ground who are actually helping, you know, not only guide these sort of bombing strikes, but also actually try to expel the groups. But then we start to go into that whole space of, you know, what does it mean to send forces back into Iraq? You know, haven't we left this battle before? And do they really want to get involved in the whole civil war in Syria? My own sense is that, yeah, airstrikes are not really going to resolve this, but I think it's really about trying to establish who on the ground we can support and provide air support to actually try to counter the threat from ISIS and some of the other groups that are out there. I think the idea that, you know, sending forces or soldiers, boots on the ground, to try to actually provide, you know, hold or clear territory out where ISIS is going, is really not going to make the situation any better. And actually, it's going to further strengthen the group, and it's going to further exacerbate their sense of being in the midst of a confrontation against the West. I mean, this group thrives on being at the heart of a sort of struggle between, by group I'm referring to ISIS, of course. They thrive at being at the heart of a struggle between, you know, Islam and the West, and they're the ones defending Islam. If the West was to start to mass forces and start launching attacks against them, well, it plays exactly their narrative, and that would bring sort of potentially untold numbers of support to their side.
I think the scale of the problem is worse because of something that is often misunderstood, I think. We often think of IS as a group or a militia, if you see what I mean. It is really much better to think about it as an army. This is an outfit commanded by ex-generals from Iraq. They have long experience of doing this kind of thing. It has a very large amount of money. It has a huge amount of weapons. This is not some little scruffy militia that just grew up last month. It's a huge, very highly organized land army. And anybody who wants to stop it really has to do quite a lot. And if they decide airstrikes aren't enough, the choices get even worse.
On that happy thought, while the fight for Kobani continues, the Islamic State's foot soldiers and supporters alike are continuing to wage their war on social media, which appears to be at least one invention of the decadent, godless 21st century West to which ISIS doesn't object. Tonight in Luxembourg, assorted technology panjandrums from Twitter, Google, Microsoft and Facebook are meeting with EU ministers to discuss the use of social media by extremists in a private dinner. Apparently. George Brock, is there anything that can practically be done? Are we not in a sort of state where you are playing whack-a-mole with this stuff? If you suppress the message in one forum or in one medium, they'll find another one.
Well, there is an inevitable cat-and-mouse element if you are trying to stop people misusing or abusing media of any kind, new media or old, but there probably are. What you can't do is uninvent new media. That is, you can't go backwards. Media is media and it's there and people will use it. But you can stop people actually deceiving people, and you can persuade the big players, the Facebooks and the Twitters and so on, to say, you really should not be lending your help or making it too easy for people to actually actively deceive people. I mean, there are lots and lots of grey areas about what might or might not be acceptable content and what might be in bad taste or poor taste. But if people are actually doing the kind of really rather sophisticated engineering whereby somebody opens an app and this distributes an IS message that they don't even know they're distributing to thousands of people, and Twitter's technology doesn't stop that, I don't think there's anything unreasonable about an individual government or a group of governments saying to Twitter, you really shouldn't be allowing that to happen. That's against everything you stand for.
Raffaello, there's always been, and this goes right back to the Symbionese Liberation Army's kidnap of Patty Hearst and the sort of the golden age of hijacking, if you will, in the 1970s. There is a symbiotic relationship between political extremism and the media. Mm. To what extent do you think, though, that some of the Islamic State's atrocities in particular have only been carried out because social media exists? I was thinking that, say, 10, 15 years ago, there would have been no mileage in making an elaborate show of beheading a hostage because nobody would have printed those pictures and nobody would have broadcast the footage. So there would have been absolutely no point in doing it. I mean, it's clearly, as George says, you can't go backwards. The technology is what it is. But to what extent are they basically waging war on social media as a whole separate battlefield?
I think it's a very interesting point. It's really something that ISIS in particular has made us all question quite a bit. There's a great line by a very good terrorism researcher from the 70s where he said, terrorism is theatre. And I think that really captures the whole sort of concept quite well, because essentially it's political violence. You're trying to get your message out there. And so whatever way gets your message out there is the way that you'll actually do it. If you talk back about the Patty Hearst thing, part of the reason that the group used Patty Hearst in their instance wasn't just that she was a bit deranged and sort of got caught up in their ideology, but it was also because she was Patty Hearst, and they knew that having her show up and doing the bank robbery would immediately elevate their sort of messaging. So I don't think that in itself it's new. I think it's just that the way they're using and the mediums that they're using are kind of new. But even that, in a way, is just a reflection of the times. I mean, to me, the fact that you're seeing ISIS as being, there's this great thing of ISIS being, so good at, using social media. Well, yes, that's true. They are. But the reason is because they've got lots of young people going to join them. And for these young people, they've been brought up, this is how they consume their media. This is how they get their information. So it's much more about tapping into that and sort of speaking out to that community rather than particular something brand new and innovative. I think that the whole question of ISIS fighting a sort of media war is also an interesting one. And I would say for that in particular, I think we can get a little bit caught up in it, however, because I would say, look at the group Al-Shabaab in Somalia that has a long track record of doing very similar things and doing very similar grim videos and putting out lots of very sort of sophisticated media messaging. In the past few weeks, Al-Shabaab has put out a number of films that have been very high production values. They look professionally made movies of like a French attempt to rescue a hostage, of them executing some other people, of some of their people on the battlefield. These haven't got any traction. So I think it's one of these things where, the fact is ISIS is the one that has all the media attention. They're the ones in the theater that we're all watching. And so that's why it's kind of getting magnified out. But
whereas
other groups
Al-Shabaab
are doing
just
well.
A bit 2012 at this point.
Well, I think so. They haven't quite mastered it in the same way.
And Andrew, I disagree with you about, it wouldn't have been worth beheading a hostage before new media arrived. Terrorist hostages got killed before new media was ever invented.
That's very true.
So the fact is, what new media, new platforms, new technologies usually do is they can often, as new media has, amplify and accelerate what has gone on. But actually, they didn't invent the killing of hostages, because the killing of hostages, Raffaello quite rightly says, is theatre. And theatre's gone on ever since one person can see another performing.
Following on from that point, though, quite a few mainstream media outlets, doubtless well-intentioned, have, especially after the first couple of beheadings of Western hostages, announced that they wouldn't use the pictures and they wouldn't use stills from the videos. Does that really make any difference, or does that actually kind of play into, I mean, ISIS's hands as well, by, you know, in the same way that it used to play into the hands of heavy metal groups when people put stickers on their sleeves saying children shouldn't hear this? Does it just make them, does it just increase the allure to people who are likely to be allured by that kind of thing?
To be honest with you, I think it's neutral to some extent. I mean, yes, it doesn't circulate the image to some degree, but it also is likely to have precisely the opposite effect on the kind of people whose loyalty and interest IS wants to engage. So actually, I think it's neither here nor there.
Raffaello, returning to this dinner tonight, just finally, it's a private dinner, as we said earlier. Can you imagine or have any idea what it is the EU ministers are likely to ask the tech giants to do?
Well, I'm sure there's going to be an element of trying to get them to help in terms of, you know, a lot of these guys are using social media, and actually social media does provide a useful tool to try to track some individuals. And so I think trying to get these companies to be willing to open up and help in the intelligence agencies access this information without them having to sort of go through secret back doors, I think that's, I'm sure, going to be one topic of the agenda. I think the other thing is trying to get them to police more actively. You know, Twitter and Facebook do a pretty good job of trying to take down, you know, terrorist groups or other images when they're put up there. But there's probably more that could be done in that direction. So I suspect they're trying to get them to engage there. And then the other thing is, I suspect that they're trying to get these companies to try to, you know, these are seen as cool companies, right? And part of this is about trying to attract people to a message. And so trying to figure out ways that maybe these organizations can put out counter messages, I think, would also be a key topic of discussion there.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, as well as Raffaello Pantucci and George Brock. When we return, we'll be looking at the media response to the Ebola crisis.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House. Earlier today, Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas confirmed the death of Thomas Duncan, the first person to be diagnosed with Ebola outside Africa since the current outbreak began. In other developments today, the US announced that it will begin screening aeroplane passengers from Sierra Leone, Liberia and Guinea. And the UK announced that 750 soldiers would travel to Sierra Leone following a US contingent already en route west Africa. George Brock, first of all, it's a depressing irony that part of the problem in West Africa has been a lack of clear, accurate, practical information and difficulties in disseminating it to the people who need to hear it. That being the case, what have you made of the media response in Europe and the United States?
I think on the whole, it's been in Europe, it's been reasonably good and reasonably sensible, and you know, people who have scientific and medical knowledge tend to be on top of the coverage. In America, in American media, there is much, much more space given to people who refuse to believe the government about anything.
Yeah.
I mean literally anything.
Yeah.
That very well-known medical specialist Donald Trump was on Fox News within the last 24 hours just basically saying everything the government is telling you about this is a lie.
It's really hard to think.
Thousands of people are going to die.
Really hard to think of a single public discussion to which Donald Trump cannot contribute immeasurably by shutting up.
And I can tell you, having listened to that conversation this morning, he didn't contribute anything to it at all. And I think we should pin a medal. There is a man called, I think if I've got his name right, Antonio Fauci from the Center for Disease Control, who has gone, crisscrossed New York and Washington and the studios of all the American media patiently, kindly, and without, as far as I can tell, ever once losing his temper with Donald Trump or anyone else explaining about Ebola, what's being done, that it isn't in fact quite as dangerous as people are liable to think. I mean, it is dangerous to people who catch it, but the, you know, the chances of an epidemic are not that high because there are plenty of control measures in. It's very bad if you're in West Africa. It's quite a lot less bad if you're in Europe or the States.
Raffaello, should the media be making slightly more of an effort, especially the American media, to remind people, one, that if you are lucky enough to live in, you know, the first world, Europe or America, you're slightly more likely to die from a lightning strike than Ebola, and indeed that 500,000 Africans die every year from malaria?
Yeah, no, I mean, clearly this is a apocalyptic disease that appears and makes people suddenly bleed to death. We may remember a few years ago, there was a couple of books that came out, or a couple of films, in fact, that followed it, like called Red Alarm or something like that, which are very prominent. They showed up with, you know, Jodie Foster and other sort of big Hollywood stars, and it really showed this sort of chaotic idea of a disease and outbreaking in the middle of American cities, from recollection. You know, zombie movies are fodder for good TV. You know, if you're an American news organization, frankly, some of them, they're competing against those same movies on other channels. So the more you can make your news somehow sound a little bit in that direction, I think is quite worrying. It is certainly something that they unfortunately do. The one thing that really I found most depressing of all the coverage around this is, I don't know if you saw Naomi Wolf, you know, the author of the book No Logo,
yes,
who made this god-awful comparison, saying how she said that essentially the American army sending forces to Africa was in fact a way of trying to get the disease back to the country to continue.
I'm just about old enough to remember Naomi Wolf writing a semi-intelligible book at one point, but she has unfortunately rather degenerated into the female Donald Trump. We should look finally at Kenya's president Uhuru Kenyatta, who, contrary to the expectations of many, arrived at the ICC in The Hague today. He's been indicted on charges of crimes against humanity pertaining to the violent aftermath of the 2007 presidential elections. The prosecution claims Kenya isn't cooperating and is refusing to hand over evidence. Here is what senior trial lawyer Benjamin Gumpert told the court.
For the court to make a ruling which will effectively be interpreted as the court saying, if a country sticks out for long enough obstructing proper inquiries being made by the prosecutor, despite the court having made a finding that that obstruction is improper, then the case against the person that country wants to protect will go away. Any such ruling would be capable, plainly capable, of that interpretation. And that would be a disastrous interpretation. It would be capable of being understood to mean that states' parties, with a legal duty to act in a particular way, can torpedo the course of justice.
George Brock, we were talking earlier about political theatre. To what extent does President Kenyatta's visit to The Hague fall into that category?
I rather suspect that it is political theatre to this degree. I think he's going to The Hague in a position of strength and confidence, not the other way round. I think he's going to The Hague because he knows they can't do much about him. And I think he is rather confident that the evidence that the court wants is probably not going to be available to it. And the court is therefore stuck. They don't want to sit there in a static position forever. And the Kenyans are saying, abandon it, it's no good, give it up. And they don't, for reasons that you've just heard in that extract, they don't want to do that either.
Raffaello, is the ICC actually helping anybody at this point? It's now been going for nearly 12 years, in which time it has, if I've done my reading right, so far convicted one minor Congolese warlord.
I think it's clearly an organization that has yet to really come into its own and figure out what and how it's able to sort of exert influence and force around the world. I mean, you know, trying to convict sitting leaders like this is very difficult. I mean, you're dealing with individuals who have a whole apparatus of state behind them and, you know, whose actual conviction probably sometimes could appear to be politically motivated by being such a prominent political figure. Kind of any action for or against them is going to be in some way have some political link to it, and that will immediately sort of reduce the sort of effectiveness and credibility of the court. You know, I think the fact that they managed to convict one person so far, I think they went after various Bosnian and Serb, I'm sorry, probably more likely to be Serb sort of criminals, and I don't know how effective all of those were, to be honest. I think some of those people died before they actually came to trial. You know, this is clearly a court that hasn't quite figured itself out, but like a lot of international institutions that we see around at the moment, like the UN is another, you know, we're dealing with a very complicated world, and it's sometimes very difficult to figure out how we create these supernatural supranational entities that are then able to exert some sort of force over the countries.
George Brock, final thought on this. Kenyatta is clearly trying to sell this narrative that the ICC is a European court that spends most of its time prosecuting Africans. Is he entirely wrong?
Well, he's entirely wrong, even if he may possibly win this round, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, he's wrong in the sense that I think the ICC is a very noble and sincere and genuine attempt, and I think it's the kind of thing which is tackling problems so huge that it really, both in the technical sense and in the political sense, that it takes a very, very long time for them to get their aim in and to get their techniques correct to do justice properly. They need to do things quicker. They probably need to pick their targets a little more carefully. But sometimes they will just get frustrated by political leaders who can block them. The Kenyan political elite, irrespective of its tribal and political divisions, does not want this to happen. And the court has found it extremely difficult to puncture that barrier.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. George Brock and Raffaello Pantucci, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Монако 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Монако 24 дес.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
There's plenty still coming up in the second half of today's show. We'll be talking to people, well, talking to our correspondent in Vancouver and finding out what some residents really don't like about their own city. And I don't know, it strikes me as a hard thing to dislike Vancouver. That said, I was only there once. It may be awful. But before we get started on all that, here's Suzanne Chislett with the world headlines.
Thank you, Andrew. Intense gunfights are continuing in the Syrian border town of Kobani, where Kurdish fighters are trying to force out Islamic State militants. US airstrikes have destroyed armoured vehicles and artillery belonging to the extremists, appearing to slow down their progress. Doctors in Dallas say the man who was being treated for Ebola has died. Thomas Eric Duncan flew into the United States from his native Liberia, where he contracted the virus. Lawyers acting for the Kenyan president Uhuru Kenyatta at the International Criminal Court have called for charges of crimes against humanity against him to be dropped. He denies orchestrating a wave of violence which swept Kenya after the 2007 election. And the European Commission has given its backing to the building of Britain's first new nuclear power station in 20 years. It had been investigating whether funding for the project, which will be built by EDF Energy, broke state aid rules. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Suzanne. Welcome back to Midori House. You're live on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. It's 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 10:32 in Vancouver, which is where we're going right now. It's time to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we are heading indeed to the west coast of Canada, where we find Monocle's correspondent, Lucy Hislop. Lucy, as I was discussing with Raffaello and George at the top of the programme there, Canada is the latest to join the air campaign against ISIS in Iraq and or Syria. How unified are Canadians' politicians on this? Has this been one there's been broad agreement about, or is there a row?
Absolutely. No, there's been a big political scrap over this, for sure. I mean, we are in the lead up to an election, and there is a kind of a whiff of that comes with kind of big attacks and big debates. But it got officially voted in, as you say, last night, and to join the airstrikes with the US-led combat mission. And I mean, we've got the Conservatives have a majority, so it was always assured passage. It was always going to get through, and it got through on a majority of 157 to 134.
That's really close.
Exactly. Well, it's really close in the sense that it's a divided House of Commons. When you've obviously got a majority, it was always going to go through. So it wasn't that there was any question about whether it was going through. It was always going to go through. But there was a lot of good debate leading up to it. And it has to be remembered that, of course, Canada didn't join in the previous combat role in Iraq. It said no to, you know, its main trading partner to the south. And I think many Canadians felt very proud that they said no, because the pressure on a small country, kind of, you know, the apocryphal riding on the back of the elephant, is that it always says yes, and it said no. So now there's sort of politicians who will say humanitarian is the way to go, not a combat role, and because we in fact didn't take part in the earlier invasion of Iraq, it gives us some sort of credibility to strengthen the political institutions in Iraq. But on the other side, it's a lot about the, you know, Canada having a duty to act, Canada heeding the call to join in the coalition forces.
What's been the nature of the debate around this? Has it been about whether Canada should be involved at all, or whether Canada being involved would actually make any difference or do any good?
Well, I think there is a little bit of that. There is the question about what role it can actually contribute. It's a small, it's small by comparison to others. Obviously, this is only a country that's 35 million strong, and so therefore it's, you know, sending 9 military aircraft, you know, 6 fighter jets and 600 personnel, which, you know, is not huge, obviously. So yes, I mean, I think that the push is that, you know, kind of how will that really contribute to the mission, and would it have been better to have just gone down a humanitarian role? And also, one of the biggest questions is that how will Canada see itself getting out of this war zone? You know, it's given itself a sort of 6-month time frame. So certainly opposition parties were demanding to know more of the reasons for the mission and what we will actually contribute.
I want to move along to a slightly more heartwarming story, which I'm not sure on reflection if heartwarming's quite the right adjective, but nonetheless, a shipwreck discovered in the Arctic. We have discussed this story on and off on Monocle 24. This is the missing ships of Sir John Franklin. What have we learnt?
Yes, absolutely. Well, yes, a few weeks ago there was the actual sort of rather sepia-like image of a ship on the seafloor. You know, it was a scan that caused much excitement. This ship was, last seen in, or set sail in 1845 to discover the treasures, the quickest route to the treasures of Asia across the Northwest Passage. And of course, I've been on an expedition up there, and it's so extraordinary because you see the Northern Lights, but they're south of your ship. So you really get to know how high you are up in the Arctic there, and how the sea ice just clams in, like a vice-like grip around your ship very, very quickly. So they lost these two ships, and no one has ever been able to find them. I think only 1% of the Arctic Ocean up there is charted. So that really goes to show that, you know, you can chart it, but it just changes as well all the time. So they saw this sepia image. Everybody was very excited. And now it's actually been going through archives and, certain testing that they do. It has been declared the Erebus, the HMS Erebus, as opposed to the Terror, which was the other one that the captain, Sir John Shanklin, was on. So there were two ships. So they found one of the two. So, yeah, I mean, it's one of those kind of, it's a real Canadian mystery. And the diver, Ryan Harris, who saw it, he kind of explains, and it's sort of all been released now, that, you know, without being excessively maudlin, you can almost hear the echoes of the sailors in the space where they would have passed time in long winters hunkered down below decks. So certainly, it's kind of one of those really, the end of that part of the mystery.
Finally, as I was mentioning a few minutes ago, I have been to Vancouver one whole time for about 24 hours in 1992 or something, and it did seem to me a perfectly agreeable city, and certainly it always polls well in Monocle's list of the world's most livable cities, but I understand one local blogger begs violently to differ.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, obviously, you need to come back for a little bit longer than 24 hours. But, yeah, there's been a little bit of a blitz of backlash from a site called I Hate Van. And say it as it is. I think it's also in reaction. There is a website. It was a very good website, but it's called Vancouver is Awesome. So, you know, it's sort of tooting your own horn somewhat. It's a kind of a tall poppy syndrome. Once you get too much praise, I guess this was kind of bound to happen, cut us down to size. And, you know, apparently some of the beefs are the fact that Vancouverites kind of, we don't dress well, apparently. I mean, I don't know if I quite agree with that. It's come a long way since 92, since you last visited, and it's certainly...
I didn't notice anybody dressed especially badly, but then this is me talking. If you are going to hate Vancouver, though, what things can you pick on? What really is there to get upset about?
Well, if you don't like yoga... You can certainly say there's too much downward dogging here because it's the home of Lululemon. So sweatpants, I mean, they're pretty de rigueur sweatpants, I have to say. They're not, you know, cheap and cheerful. It's you can complain about that, I guess, but I'm not sure if it's necessarily worth complaining about. One of the things that they say on this blog is that we kind of don't laugh enough at ourselves. And I would say that, I mean, obviously I'm an immigrant here. And so this site, to me, is just simply a great way to laugh at yourself. It doesn't bother me in the slightest.
Are people seeing the funny side, or are people in between yoga lessons getting genuinely quite upset?
Yes, that's right, in between poses. Well, the Huffington Post did sort of do a whole piece on why they think the city's totally wonderful. So I don't know. I think that sounded a little bit defensive in my thing. It would have been better to just go with, well, are we like that? Because one of the things they say is the kind of flakiness of it all. I mean, if people say, oh, you must come for dinner, don't think it's actually going to happen. And I would totally agree with that.
Well, listeners can judge for themselves either by going to Vancouver or just looking at ihatevan.tumblr.com. Lucy Hislop in Vancouver, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming up for 1841 here in London. Up next, we'll be hearing about the opening of Morocco's first contemporary art museum.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luskin. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luscombe, every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's no man's sight.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Rabat, Morocco's capital, struggles to attract visitors away from the country's bigger tourist draws of Fez, Casablanca and Marrakesh, which is entirely the visitors' loss. Rabat is beautiful, temperate and prides itself on subjecting those who do come to absolutely none of the hassle often associated with Middle Eastern cities. Hopefully adding to Rabat's appeal is the opening of the Mohammed VI Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art, a decade in the making and the first institution of its kind in Morocco. Hassan Alawi is a freelance independent journalist in Rabat. He's just had a tour of the new museum. I spoke to him earlier.
It's a very fascinating building right in the middle of Rabat. It's a 3-floor building, and from outside it's just stunning. It's not a modern architecture because it should blend with the whole place where it is, because it's in the middle of Rabat, not far away from a mosque, from the royal palace and from other buildings here in the city center. So I spoke to one of the architects who was one of the team who was behind it, and they said they wanted a building that is at the same time modern and not ancient, but traditional. So there is plenty of Arab traditional architecture there, but at the same time is not that classical architecture as you may find in older cities like Marrakesh or Fez or even in Rabat. So it's a very, very beautiful building, 3 floors, as I said, white from outside, And inside, it's just stunning as it is from outside.
Well, that mix you mentioned between, I guess, traditional Arab architecture and more modernist architecture is very reflective of Rabat itself, which is, of course, divided between the beautiful old part of town and the newer part built by the French. I look forward to seeing it next time I'm there. So that's what the building looks like. What's actually in it? What is the inaugural exhibition consisting of?
Well, there is an inaugural exhibition called 100 years of creation, and it goes back to 1914 until this year, 2014. So we had all the major artists who were there, or most of them have died, but some of them are still alive. It's a collection that shows how modern or Moroccan art evolved over the last century, but this art actually only started properly in the 50s and the 60s, and now we have at least four or five generations of recognized masters of the 80s, 90s, and the current crop of artists we have now, and some of them are very famous, probably not world artists like Damien Hirst or something like that, but they are very well appreciated all over the world, and you can find their work in some museums and private collections all over the world. I met some years ago an artist who lives in Marrakesh, and his art is very, very popular in Tokyo, in Japan. And as I said, you can find a lot of Moroccan artists now in private collections in France, in the United States, everywhere.
This project has been a long time in the making, of course. What has been the reaction in Rabat, both among the public and among the press, to it finally being opened?
This project has not been open to the public yet. It was opened by the king himself yesterday, a very big ceremony, as you can guess, when the king is there. So he invited all the artists to be there. He invited all the former culture ministers to be there as well. And then there was a dinner at their honor given by the king himself. So it was really a big occasion.
I also need to ask, obviously part of the reason this museum has been opened is to try and draw more tourists, not just to Rabat in particular, but to Morocco in general. Morocco has been in the news in Britain a lot this week over the arrest and imprisonment of Ray Cole, a British man arrested for no better reason than the fact that he happens to be gay. Are people concerned about how damaging stories like that are for Morocco's image overseas?
Well, I covered this story from Morocco myself, and when I was asked, do you think this gentleman was arrested just for being gay? My reply was no, because we have gay people in Morocco, Moroccans who are gay. We have a lot of people who are gay among the 10 million tourists who come to Morocco. And apparently, as long as they keep their sexual inclinations for themselves, nobody bothers them. Morocco is a very well open society. Even if we are Muslim by religion, we are very tolerant. I think you've been here yourself, so I'm not telling you something you probably don't know. I'm sure that Morocco is very keen to develop its tourism, and only last week we had this national convention for tourism, and Moroccans are expecting, or at least are hoping, to attract something like 20 million tourists by the year 2020 and make Morocco one of the top destinations by the year 2020. So definitely tourism is very, very important. It's the second industrial activity in Morocco. It brings a lot of current hard currency, something like 60 billion Moroccan dirhams, and it employs nearly 2.5 million people directly and indirectly. So a museum like that definitely will attract a lot of people. And I asked this question this morning to one of the top officials at the press conference, and I told him, do you think that we will have the Guggenheim effect in Morocco? Do you think that this museum will attract thousands or probably millions of tourists? He said, it's not only this museum. We have a lot of things to offer tourists in Rabat and in Morocco as a whole. So if this monument or this cultural exhibitions can bring tourists to Morocco, that's well and fine, because Morocco has so many things going for it to attract foreign tourists.
That was Hassan Alawi speaking to me earlier from Rabat. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now for some music, sticking with the Moroccan theme. This is an artist from that very country. It's Nawas Impulse with La Hila Express. That was Nawas Impulse with La Hila Express, a remix thereof. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming up to the top, well, the top of the hour and the bottom of the show, which means it's time for our daily arts review. Today we're talking comedy, and we're talking it with Bruce Dessau, editor-in-chief of comedy website beyondthejoke.co.uk. First of all, Bruce, it's a topic that comes up from time to time in comedy, as indeed in most other arenas of the arts, as to whether or not it's an especially welcoming arena for female artists. But some of the big sellers this year are exactly that.
Well, that's it. And sort of sensate, you know, these things that are anecdotal, that there seem to be a lot of good female comedians at the moment. There have been some figures out recently saying that, you know, not just the comedy is selling well, but that more people are buying tickets for gigs by women than ever before. I think three times as many in the last 3 years, the figures have gone up substantially. Women are doing much bigger tours. Of course, this year we've just had Miranda Hart, who was the first woman to do a solo show at an arena tours. And she's coming back. She's actually at Wembley Arena this weekend.
Which for non-Londoners, we should point out, is that that's no small thing, literally. That's 12,000 people isn't it?
And all around the country as well. And due to popular demand, added extra dates. You know, and there's always been, as you say, there's always been this thing, you know, are women funny? Can women entertain big audiences? And I think Miranda Hart, Sarah Millican, they've shown that they can.
I mean, has something actually shifted noticeably, or is it just the fact that there is a coincidence of a couple of comedians who happen to be female who've become successful at the same time?
Well, I think the shift may be that they're doing very well on television. You know, they've both had their own TV shows, and I think that's the way you sell tickets these days. It used to be you sold tickets by gigging and by word of mouth, but these days, you know, Miranda Hart's got a successful sitcom, Sarah Millican's had a successful show in the UK. These are the things that get your name out there. And also there's been the talk of panel shows, putting women on panel shows. So their profile on television is higher. And that's why they sell more tickets when they go on tour.
Well, moving seamlessly along on the subject of gigs, you have been to some recently. Were there any that leapt out at you?
Yeah, I went to an unusual gig, actually. Funny you should ask, Saturday night. It's... You know, I go to.
I know it's like I've got it all written down here in front of me or something.
But I get out. You know, I go to gigs most nights of the week in London. But I went to a different one on Saturday night. I went to a gig in a cemetery, which I guess the headline would be dead funny. It was actually a gig in the cemetery. Live comedy.
Tough crowd, you would think.
In a no heckling, yeah. Yeah, it was in East London in Tower Hamlets Cemetery Park. Stuart Lee, who again is another great comedian, he's a kind of cult comedian, but he's a cult comedian who can sell out big venues night after night after night. He headlined a gig in a cemetery. Very cold, but very interesting, because you were taken through the graveyard. There was also sort of little performances on graveyards, puppet show on one graveyard.
So was it kind of a movable thing? Were you kind of taken on a guided tour of the cemetery?
Yeah. In fact, it was quite a strange... I think it's an organisation that's never done this before, but I think it was successful enough that once the weather gets a bit warmer, maybe not for the winter, but next summer, I think they'll do it again. You sat down, you watched a little bit of comedy, then you all got up, all 400 of us, and were guided on a path lit by flames around the cemetery. And it's very spooky. It's a bit like Père Lachaise in Paris, or I guess Highgate, where Marx is buried. It's a very spooky... In fact, I'm not sure if it's you. It's a Victorian cemetery, very Gothic. So really atmospheric. And, you know, I love that. Maybe I'm a bit jaded going to a lot of comedy gigs, but to do something in a different location, I wish there were more gigs like that.
It does make a change from stage with seats in front of it.
Yes, yes. I once had a gig in my house. That was probably my favourite unusual gig.
It would save you on taxi fares. How did that happen?
Well, actually, it came about because I wrote an article about how difficult it was to park in London. And so one very inventive promoter said, if I put on a gig in my house, if I bring my acts to your house, you'll have to review them and you can't complain about the parking, which is exactly what he did. Brought three acts. We closed the curtains. I think the neighbours wondered what was going on because the windows steamed up. But it was terrific. And no problems parking. No problems with traffic. I wish more gigs were like that.
But that aside, did Stuart Lee, who is a very, very funny comedian and whose book I recommend heartily to anybody who hasn't already read it, the How I Escaped or whatever it was.
Yeah, My Certain Fate.
My Certain Fate, yeah. That's it. I've forgotten the title, but I remember the book very well. Yeah. Did he kind of tailor his you know, whether kind of liminally or subliminally, tailor his material to the somewhat unusual surroundings?
Yes and no. He's basically doing a lot of gigs around town at the moment. In fact, you should try and catch him because he's rehearsing material for his new BBC series. So he's trying to. But there was a moment when he was nearly attacked by a strange moth, and he had to sort of rather improvise when the moth sort of got heckled by a moth, which doesn't often happen when you're playing arenas, but it can happen when you're playing graveyards.
And that aside, is there anything coming up you're especially looking forward to?
Yeah, I think you know, let's do a little bit of a charity here. There are a couple of really good benefit gigs coming up in London, both compared by Daniel Kitson, who's a great comedian and a great compere. This Thursday night, he's doing a benefit at King's Place in King's Cross for leukemia research. And then on the 30th of October at Hackney Empire, Daniel Kitson's comparing a benefit for Shelter, the homelessness charity. I think, you know, he's worth seeing and it's a good cause. You can't go wrong for both those reasons.
Indeed not. Bruce Dessau, thank you very much. It's Bruce Dessau, editor-in-chief of beyondthejoke.co.uk. And that is all for today's edition of Midori House. My thanks also to our earlier guests, Raffaello Pantucci and George Brock. The show was produced by Emily Elias, researched by David Pleasant and Muriel Kawagi, and our studio manager was Joel Church. After the headlines, The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli, at 2200, The Monocle Daily with me and Emma Nelson. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. For this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
London. Tao Beijing.
This is Monaco 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monaco 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.